Welcome to The Big Web Show. My name is Jeffrey Zeldman, the host of The Big Web Show. Big Web Show is everything web that matters, and today, my guest is the lovely and talented Val Head. Val Head is a designer and consultant who just moved to Philly. She runs Web Design Day, is the managing editor of CreativeJS.com, and just wrote the CSS Animations Pocket Guide for Five Simple Steps. Hi, Val.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Our pleasure. So talk about the book. What are CSS animations exactly, and how do you use them for anything other than novelty?
Yeah, well, the book is it's a pocket guide on five simple steps, and it's a nice, I guess, short and to the point book that basically I wanted to kind of explain more what the spec is, because I find the spec really, really confusing as it's written. So I wrote the book to kind of help make that whole CSS animation spec and exactly what all those properties do a whole lot more approachable and I think a lot more fun to read than the actual spec, because that's pretty terrible.
You're talking about the specification at w3.org.
Yeah, yeah.
CSS3-animations is the
that one. Nice long title. So, yes, I wrote the book about about what that does and making it a little bit more approachable, in the hopes that people will incorporate it more into their work. Because I think there's a lot of opportunities that we can use this stuff, and I mean it's pretty awesome to have this in CSS now. So I think we should all take advantage of it wherever we can.
Well, give me an example. I'm going to your web app.
Mm-hmm.
Am I clicking? Does a button glow and get big when I hover over it? I mean, what exactly happens? What are some things that you can do with this?
Yeah, you can do that kind of stuff. I mean, definitely lots of things to, you know, draw more attention to whatever buttons and that kind of thing. I mean, there's obviously a fine line with that between what looks really awesome and what is annoying, but, you know, we're all good judges of that, I'm sure. And it's also really, all these UI transitions are just really great for kind of softening the edges of things and making it, you know, more pleasurable to interact with things. You know, we see a lot of these UI animations used in a lot of, you know, native apps, and some of them are amazingly well designed and just a huge pleasure to use. And we don't see that as much on the web yet. So I'm kind of hoping we start to, and we start, you know, having CSS being able to do this is a huge step towards it, because, you know, it's done in the browser. That's a huge, huge advantage.
So you're kind of fighting for equality of the web with native.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can make experiences on the web just as sophisticated and just as fun. We have the tools to do it. It's just, you know, I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but still, I'd like to see it happen.
You run workshops on this, do you not?
I do, yeah. I haven't done one in a while since I just moved, but I'm going to do some more in the new year.
You were doing them over the summer, though, I know.
Mm-hmm. I was doing them over the summer. Did some in Pittsburgh, did some in, in Vancouver. So a little bit all over.
Are they full-day workshops?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we spend all day. Some of them are half days, but usually it's a full day on, you know, how to use animations in CSS, you know, just basically the syntax of it, and then getting into where are some good places to use it, and, you know, hopefully setting people up to have a little fun and then maybe think of where they can use this in their work as well.
Are these hands-on workshops?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We use CodePen and actually just have everyone kind of dive into the examples and start editing right away.
How did you become a workshopper? You're very well known in the web community as a presenter and leader. And how did that happen exactly?
I'm not sure. I mean, I've always really been involved in local community things like user groups and meetups. And I found that's where I learned the most of everything I've learned when it comes to all this crazy web stuff. So I just kind of wanted to do more and share more of what I learned with other people. You know, with the workshops, a lot of it is just, my goal is to kind of get people to maybe learn something a little bit new, just find something fun about it and something that makes them interested enough to want to learn more. And if I can help them do that, that's pretty awesome. It makes me happy.
Have you found, as a woman, that like you have encouragement out there? Have you encountered some of the problems other women have reported where it's sort of still treated as a guy's domain? I mean, you do a lot of JavaScript. not just mm-hmm. CSS animations. And do you find it difficult to bust through prejudice about women coders, or?
I think I've had a pretty good run of it compared to some people. I know some people have some pretty terrible stories about things that have happened to them. I've really seen more of a positive and supportive community, at least with, you know, places I've worked and, you know, people I've just kind of run into on the internet, the crazy internet we all hang out on. But maybe in a way I'm kind of lucky that I haven't had anything terrible happen. It seems I've had a pretty good and pretty positive run of things. That makes me pretty happy. But I know that's not, I don't know, it's not been the same for everyone, which is kind of sad. I think even, you know, I think sometimes we get a little mean on the internet and is maybe, you know, criticize each other a little more than we really need to.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if we could all just be a little happier and, you know, I don't know, hang out and you know, constructive criticism instead of telling someone they totally suck or, you know, what other insulting things you can say.
Yeah, I don't know whether that's not everyone had the training where you get critiques and know how to give critiques. I think that's a problem in our industry because a lot of us didn't go to design school. We did something else. So we're kind of on our own.
Yeah.
Figuring out how to give feedback. That can be a problem. And then go ahead.
Even in school, critiques were pretty rough, you know. They weren't necessarily the kinds of things that you always want to relive in your professional career.
But they're guided in school.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a free-for-all. There's goals.
It's not people picking on you, and it's not – I don't think saying fail is a critique, right?
No, it's not.
You try something, and it immediately – it doesn't work the first time you try it, and you, like, tweet fail, and you're done. That doesn't seem like – and we do a lot of that as a community.
Yeah, I think it's so easy with Twitter, you know? You're just like, oh, I can just say something like, oh, that sucks, and then just leave it at that. But I don't even know if that helps you as the person expressing that. Does it make you feel better? It doesn't really make anyone else feel better.
I love Twitter, I got to say. And, I love the opportunity to see how short I can write something and be effective. I mean, to me, that's the fun of it. So if I can say something funny or once every 3 years insightful in like,
it's hard on Twitter.
I try to leave 15 characters. I try to actually remove 15 additional characters so that people can retweet me and include my name in it. That's how sad I am as a,
no, it's
as
an
a
extra
human
challenge.
Being. Yeah. I give myself that extra challenge out of needing those validation points. So you, this is your first book, right? CSS Animations Pocket Guide.
Yeah, yeah, it's the first one I ever wrote, and definitely makes me appreciate the effort that goes into writing full-length books. Holy crap, that must be hard. Pocket guides are like under 10,000 words. That's really not that long.
Right. I don't know. I don't know how many thousands of words, but I know it's a short book. I have the book. It's a very nice book. How big a struggle was this, and how long did it take, and what was your process?
We worked on it over a course of maybe like 3 months or so, mostly just writing on weekends. And then, you know, just kind of, I put together an outline first and 5 simple steps, took a look at it, and they were like, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do it. And then that was kind of the moment where I was like, oh, now I have to write it. Okay.
You reached out to them.
Yeah, they were looking for some new topics, and I suggested this one, and they were like, yeah, that sounds great. What would an outline look like? So, you know, I put that together, and it's pretty, you know, compared to writing a book, putting an outline together is pretty fast. Put that together, shared it with a few people. They're like, oh, that sounds good. Sent it to 5 simple steps. And they're like, it's great. Now we should start. But they were great for the whole process. I think a lot of pocket guide authors, it's their first time writing a book. So 5 simple steps are just, they're super supportive and they're really helpful. And like anytime you had questions about like, how is this going to work? They had lots of information for you. And it's the whole process made me really love working with editors. Owen Gregory was my editor, and I was kind of afraid at first of what's going to happen when I send this thing that's like I've spent, you know, a few weekends in a row writing. It's a bunch of chapters. It's like 5 chapters long. I've made all these examples, and I'm sending it to some guy I don't know, and he's going to tell me what's wrong with it. Like that's kind of what I thought editing was, but it's not. You know, it's much more teamwork than that. You know, the editors help you actually, express your ideas better, how to make what you're saying clearer, and just offer a ton of really useful feedback and just making the book and whatever you're writing in the end so much better. So I love editors now.
Owen Gregory. Mm-hmm. I've heard such good things about him as an editor.
Oh, he's great.
Andrew Clark and I were in Norway a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago, and he was just raving about him, like how helpful he was on a long book, Hard Boiled.
Oh, yeah, I think we were both talking about, I think I was talking to him about the editing as well. So, yeah, we had the same editor.
I was very lucky. My first, my first editor, I wrote for New Writers. I had a good editor there, but my first editor that I picked was Erin Kassane, and she mm-hmm. was just wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
And I've just been so lucky through the years with really one amazing editor, Krista Stevens, after another, mm-hmm. just incredible. And it makes all the difference.
It really does.
I think they're like, to me, they're kind of like directors who can look at a script and visualize the film, right? Mm-hmm. They don't write the script. You do that. They can't do their job without you, but then they can, I've worked with Mandy Brown a lot, and she can look at an outline and go, yeah, chapter two should really be chapter. She can visualize the whole finished book and go, chapter two and chapter three should be combined. You don't need chapter one. I mean, in a nice way, right? But like can really look at something and figure it out. And that is just an amazing talent to have.
It really is. I mean, it's so, especially when you're writing and you're looking at all the specifics and you're just kind of so into the details of it, it's really easy to get lost in as far as like what the point of the book is or where you're going. Like you could probably go off and write for days and maybe have to just toss it all if you didn't have someone kind of helping guide you along.
What about,
you know, make sure you're making sense.
Did you have technical editors too?
Yes, I did. I also had, Simon was my technical editor, and that was super helpful in just, you know, going over the examples with me and finding, it's putting any amount of code out to people on the internet, is very scary, especially based on all the critiquing we were talking about earlier. So it's great to have someone there to actually check that and, make sure I was doing things that made sense and finding all those random bugs and just other things that you can't really do when you're looking at your own code because you're too stuck in it.
What now? You're a big proponent of JavaScript, right? You mm-hmm. run. You are the managing editor of Creative.js,
yes.
Creative JavaScript, CreativeJS.com. What made you? What is the appeal to you, or what is the what is the benefit of CSS animation over JavaScript animation? Is there an advantage? Is it easier? Is there a semantic benefit, a usability benefit, accessibility, anything?
I think they both have their advantages and disadvantages. I mean, CSS's main advantage is that the animations are essentially, run in the browser and interpreted by the browser, which is one level, I guess, closer to the, the source, if you want to think of it that way.
JavaScript doesn't?
No, JavaScript is kind of run in its own separate layer on top. So it's kind of like, it's a little bit more separate in that way. And since CSS is interpreted by the browser, or CSS animations are, that gives you a potential of having way better performance and having it handled better. And browsers are doing amazingly better at making these animations smooth and fast. I know Paul Irish and a couple other people from the Chrome team have written about that a bunch on HTML5 Rocks, of just some really great things about performance. And those things, JavaScript can't really compete with. But also sometimes, since the browser is responsible for so much, browsers don't always agree on how things should work, as we all know. So you can run into some very interesting quirks, and there's nothing you can do because it's the browser. You can't tell it to interpret your code differently, right? So it's a big advantage, I think, for the most part. Occasionally quirks. And JavaScript can't really compete with that. But the one thing JavaScript can do is you can do more, physics-based animations. You can do animations that respond to input, respond to changes more easily. CSS animations are generally, set it and play it. You can manipulate them a little, but not as much as if you were doing a pure JavaScript animation or if you were doing something purely in Canvas, let's say. You know, there's there's a certain amount of control you have to give up if you're doing CSS. Or maybe not give up, but if you want it still, you're going to have to go through a heck of a lot more work to get it. So, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages to both. I don't think they're really equal. Those CSS animations can cover a lot of the ground that we need to do. So it's not like one's, you know, terrible and one's amazing. They both have good things.
How did you get into this path? Did you do a lot of gaming as a kid or play with computers as a kid or math? What was the story there?
Actually, we had computers and stuff when I was a kid, but I didn't really, I was really more interested in, or I didn't really get interested in them too much except for like drawing with them. We used to draw ridiculous things. We had something before Microsoft Paint. I don't even know. I know my dad got us some programming books, but we were just like, oh, we want to draw characters. We don't care. And I never really got into programming until I took an animation class in university. They actually taught this animation class in Flash, and we were animating stuff, and I got to a point where I was like, hey, I'd really like to have this thing happen where it's interactive and like this thing does this other stuff. And they were like, well, you can't do that on the timeline. You need to use ActionScript for that. And I was just kind of completely amazed at the idea that you could write code to move things around on the screen, and that just kind of changed my life.
What were you studying at the time?
This was actually just... I was studying business at the time. Actually, this was just a random class that I'd taken outside of that because I've always found this stuff way more interesting than business.
Sure.
So it was just kind of like a course I took just for fun, and then I was like, "Oh, you can do this! This is amazing! I need to do this."
Was this in Pittsburgh? Where you're from?
I'm not from Pittsburgh. Actually, that was actually in Buffalo, but I'm not from Buffalo either.
Okay.
I'm from Toronto originally. I've just moved around a bunch.
Okay, so. That's how you were able to go to school in Buffalo, because you're from Toronto, so you were used to the cold up there. I remember when I was in high school going up to Buffalo to check out this, because they had this great school, or I thought they did, and it was just cold for me.
Oh, Buffalo is one of the snowiest, most coldest places I've ever lived, but they have some of the, because of the universities, they have some of the coolest people I've ever met too. So, yeah.
And the architecture, I think, is supposed to be amazing in Buffalo.
Oh, it really is.
They have sort of an abandoned downtown, mm-hmm. which is sad, but it's tragic, but it, with these amazing buildings. My friend Fred is from Buffalo, and I get a lot of Buffalo info.
Definitely. There's a whole, like, I guess, I don't even know, I guess, like, urban explorers or something like that, that go through Buffalo and take all these amazing pictures of these abandoned buildings. It's beautiful. Sad and beautiful, but mostly beautiful.
When we moved to Pittsburgh, like, mm-hmm. part of what I fell in love with as a kid in Pittsburgh was the romance of the abandoned factories. And, I mean, that's tragic, right? But to see these, like, lifts and trains and all these things that used to move people and we're now sort of being overgrown with weeds again.
Mm-hmm. There was just to think of what they were and just the fact that they're still there.
There was something, really Ozymandias, or really like the passing of all things. I don't know exactly, but it made me very melancholy as a kid in a way that I enjoyed. I guess.
Yeah, Pittsburgh has some of that too. They definitely have more of the, I guess, like abandoned industrial type things.
Yeah.
Downtown's not abandoned like Buffalo, but there's still that flavor of, you know, this past time that's still around.
Which they're turning into, I guess, condos and fancy restaurants now, right?
So for the most part, I was really sad. A couple years ago, they actually, I guess, sandblasted off one of my favorite ghost signs in the strip in Pittsburgh to put in lofts. I was very angry. It's like, I loved that sign. How dare you ruin it?
Was it one of those flashing neon signs they had downtown?
No, it was the an auto milk one painted on the side of this building, but they, you know, tore down that wall and took it all off for more condos.
Were they able to preserve the sign when they did that?
They didn't even bother. They just, like, took it right off. I mean, I don't think they even tried to save it at all, which I thought it would have made a great addition to the building, but apparently they don't agree.
There should be a museum for that stuff, like the neon...
Mm-hmm, the neon boneyard, or whatever it's called.
Yeah, in Las Vegas, where all the old neon signs live on. Pittsburgh is, I remember when we moved there, again, just seeing like neon of like dogs pulling a stocking. It was like a store that sold lingerie or just stockings. And it just showed a lady like holding onto her stocking and a dog was biting the other end, I guess to show how strong they were. So, so strong you could wrestle your dog for your stocking, I guess.
Yeah, but it was animated. Happens a lot.
And the Westinghouse thing, do they still have that where they have these three little faces made out of the Westinghouse logo that animate, they go through something like 1,000 different mathematical permutations and you could like, you could sit on a mountain across the river and look at that sign for hours, which is I kind of did in high school.
I don't think they have that one still, but there's definitely, I mean, Pittsburgh has some pretty amazing signs, I've always thought.
I wonder that they don't shoot more movies there.
They do shoot a lot of movies, though.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Most of the time, they make it look like New York, or they pretend it's New York, which I think is kind of funny.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So the Pennsylvania sweetens the deal and says, like, you get a tax break if you shoot here or whatever.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Because the last Batman was shot partly there, but they did all these shots in the movies where the like low hanging shots are in Pittsburgh and then they pan up to the sky and it's like the New York skyline, and that threw me off for the whole movie.
See, I wish they would just let Pittsburgh be Pittsburgh and let New York be New York and all that.
Yeah. Well, they did that in Jack Reacher. Tom Cruise let it be Pittsburgh, so I guess he's got that going for him.
You saw that?
Yes.
Was that good?
No, it was terrible, but I saw it in Pittsburgh, and because it's a movie shot in Pittsburgh and acknowledges it's shot in Pittsburgh, people applauded at the end of the movie. It was awesome. Totally get that.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot more things in just a minute, but it's time to thank our sponsor. HostGator is the sponsor of today's show. HostGator is the best place to get a website. They offer premium web hosting at low cost. Grab a .net. .net is the best way to get a killer domain name that's not 180 characters. Now, HostGator offers 24/7/365 phone, chat, and email support. HostGator offers hosting for any size site with shared VPS and dedicated servers. They can move your site for you if you want to transfer it to them. Do you, Valerie, do you need a website for your next killer startup idea or cat blog? HostGator.com has you covered. HostGator.com offers premium web hosting at low prices. And while you're there, grab a .net. Getting a short, memorable domain name can be a challenge, as we know. But .net has lots of great options available. And if your site explodes, getting internet famous, HostGator still has you covered with VPS and dedicated servers. Have a website somewhere else and not happy? HostGator will move it for you. They do all the hard work. Head over to HostGator.com, buy some hosting, get some .nets, and use coupon code WEB, that's coupon code W-E-B, all caps, coupon code WEB to get an extra 25% off and support the Big Web Show. I'm sure you figured out that coupon code WEB and Big Web Show are related. So head to HostGator.com, buy yourself some hosting, get some .nets, and use coupon code W-E-B, WEB, all caps, to get an extra 25% off and support this show. And so we thank them very much. So we back to Valerie Head, designer, consultant. You're freelancing now, correct?
I am, yes.
In Philadelphia. Did you you were in Pittsburgh for
6 years.
Okay. And you'd built up clientele and you'd started the Web Design Day conference there?
I did, yeah. We've been running that for the last 5 years.
You're still doing that, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. We just did one a couple weeks ago. It seems like it was yesterday, but I guess it was a couple weeks ago, right at the end of October.
Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are so different. They don't even seem like they're part of the same state.
They are really different. I mean, I guess it's a five-hour drive, but they still seem more different than that.
Yeah, well, Pittsburgh's kind of closer to Ohio. Mm-hmm. And feels Midwestern in some ways, and Philly feels very East Coast,
yeah,
gritty, urban.
It definitely feels much more like, I mean, it is a much bigger city. I think Philly's like one of the top three or four biggest cities in the States or something crazy like that. And it definitely, I mean, it feels much huger. And Philly seems much more about like the state and the history and everything that's happened here. You know, like there's tons of stuff named like Second State, whatever, and all that sort of thing. And Pittsburgh kind of feels like it's more about Pittsburgh. You know, everyone's like, yay, Pittsburgh, awesome. So it seems like a little more I don't know, I guess like self-focus in a way, even though that sounds bad, but it shouldn't be because I think it's good.
when we moved to Pittsburgh the first time the Pirates won the World Series.
Oh, wow.
And we didn't know that was happening. And we were driving on the highway and all of a sudden people were just like driving back and forth from lane to lane, honking their horns, going crazy, sticking their butts out the windows. And my dad pulled over next to someone and said, "What happened?" And this man yelled, "Parts won." Parts won. And we had no idea. We had no idea where we were coming from. We had no idea what he had said or what that meant. And it was crazy. And then a few years later, they won again. And, man, that was but I wanted to go out and celebrate. My friends mm-hmm. were all doing it. I was like maybe 13 or 14.
Yeah.
And I was really a naive kid. You know, I asked my dad's, my friend Mike called me and said, "Come on, Zeldman, you got to go downtown. They're rolling out beer barrels. Everyone can drink. Everyone thinks crazy. People are taking off their clothes and having sex. You got to come out." So I asked my dad if I could go downtown. And he said, "Why?" And I told him that.
Oh, no.
Because the bartenders are rolling out beer barrels and everyone's having sex. And he was like, "No, I don't think you can go."
Good try, then.
I didn't get – it took me a while to figure out how to be a kid.
Oh, no.
I was, like, too honest.
Yeah, definitely a little too honest there.
But honesty and transparency, good web values, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to take Web Design Day to Philly?
I don't think so. I think we were discussing that a little bit after the conference this past month. And I think Web Design Day itself, a lot of the character that it has to do with the fact that it's in Pittsburgh and a community there. I mean, so many people who come in to attend or speak from out of town just have such great things to say about the community and how it's so open and sharing and like one of the best ones they've ever been to, which is awesome to hear and like wonderful. I mean, I can't really take that much credit for it because it's the community, it's not me. But I feel like maybe that's a lot of what makes Web Design Day what it is. So if we want to do something in Philly, maybe it needs to be its own thing and kind of have its own personality and not try to just transplant this thing that's worked really well somewhere else to a new place. Maybe it needs to be its own thing. So that's kind of what I'm thinking right now. I think it might be a little more affected by its location than maybe I originally realized.
The one you just had was in on the north side.
Mm-hmm. On the north side, the New Hazlett Theater, which is funny they pronounce it that way, but that's all right. It's their name.
And it's Carnegie Music Hall originally, right?
No, the music hall is in Oakland, but it does say Carnegie Hall on it because it was part of one of the first libraries, the Carnegie Libraries on the north side. Of course, that library it's not really a library anymore. It's just kind of abandoned. But the theater is still there, so they renamed it. And it's just kind of funny because it does say Carnegie Hall on the outside in the stone.
So it's pronounced Carnegie Hall in New York, but Pittsburghers say Andrew Carnegie.
They do. I don't know why in 6 years I just can't pronounce it that way. I didn't realize it was even the same word when I first moved. I had the same problem you did understanding some of the Pittsburgh
lingo. But it is
lingo.
That guy. It's the same guy. I wonder what's the actual pronunciation of his name.
I don't know. I mean, in Pittsburgh, it's all Carnegie, but like you said, it's always, you know, there's also some other really interesting Pittsburgh words that I'm not sure are correct either. I love them, though.
How did you, how big is the conference Web Design Day now?
This past one was around 300 people. So for the main conference in the theater, we had about 300 folks, all web design people from various places. I mean, most of our attendees are from a drivable distance to Pittsburgh, but we get some people flying in for it as well. We had a couple people from Texas and stuff, which I thought was pretty impressive. And then we started doing workshops the second day as of this year, and that was, you know, closer to like under 100 people. We have nice small workshops, but about 300 people for the main conference, which was a pretty nice crowd.
That is super cool. What is the H1 on the website?
Oh, it was...
is that your home button?
Yeah, that's our little logo. It was kind of one of those things where, you know, we're like, we're going to start a web conference. Awesome. We'll call it Web Design Day. Well, of course, the logo should be an H1 on a calendar. Yes. And now 5 years later, we're like, wow, we should put more thought into that.
But see, I always think that whatever you started with, it becomes heritage after a while.
Yeah, I thought about changing it. I was thinking about, you know, changing the whole brand of Web Design Day for this fifth one. I'm like, maybe it's time for a change. But I decided against it because I'm like, you know, we've been doing this. It's how it started. It started out as a really small, just kind of on a whim sort of thing, and it's grown into something so much more amazing. And I'm not going to mess with that right now.
Look at these people. Sarah Watcher-Betcher, speaking of great editors, and
yes.
Chris Cashdollar, Jen Meyercheck.
Mm-hmm.
How do you come up with the right balance of speakers and content? How do you figure out what people need to hear? Because it also seems like it's a single track, holistic.
It is. It's one track, one day. So that does make it tough because there's a lot of pressure to make the right decision, right? I mean, I'm sure you guys have the same thing with Event Apart where it's one track. So you need to kind of, we know our audience is a mix of designers and developers and then, you know, people who like run the shop or project managers, that kind of thing. So we try to have talks that will hit something for all of them, at least a little bit. You know, we're not going to have a talk that's entirely aimed at developers for 45 minutes because, you know, that's 2/3 of your audience might be alienated by that or at least a little bit less interested. So we try really hard to get a good mix and try to go by what it seems like people are interested in. I mean, it helps to be involved in the community and see what people are talking about and trying to follow that up follow that with things they would be interested in seeing. And the other goal we have is to always get some local people from Pittsburgh as well. So we always have a mix of, you know, like national people, if you want to call them that, as well as local speakers too. So, and actually in the first 3 years, we had a rule that every speaker had to have lived in Pittsburgh or had family in Pittsburgh. And that got a little tough after 3 years though.
Yeah. What was that about?
We just thought it would be kind of a cute thing to do since it was Web Design Day and it was in Pittsburgh. And we were able to do it for 3 years. You know, we had people like, you know, Kevin Hoffman and Chris Cashdollar used to live here. Whitney Hess went to school here. Samantha Warren has family here. So we had a pretty long list of people.
Liz Danzico also went to school.
Did she? Oh, yeah, she went to CMU. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of Pittsburgh connections. So we figured we'd kind of play off of that. But then we realized, you know, it's more about the content and curating a good group of speakers and less so about where they've come from.
Sure. So. But it's interesting. In Canada, did they have you grew up in Canada, right?
Mm-hmm, I did.
Was there a certain percentage, like when you went to the movies, wasn't there a rule that a certain percentage of films had to be Canadian?
The Canadian content rule.
you don't want to just, and that's true everywhere. They don't want to just be inundated with American products.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was like 40% or something, or maybe I'm making it higher than it really was. But yeah, there was a certain percentage that had to be Canadian content on like TV, radio, movies, everything.
So this was an extension of that, right? This was like, you gotta have some root in Pittsburgh, some roots in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm.
And we still do. We still always have local people taking the stage. I mean, our workshops were all local guys. And then Jen and Rob of our Lightning Talk speakers were local. So, you know, we've always got a good Pittsburgh representation on stage as well.
See, if I didn't know any of these people, if I was out of the industry, mm-hmm. I would guess Rob Werbowski would be from Pittsburgh just because his name is Rob Werbowski.
he is.
Yeah, because of the ethnic makeup of a lot of Pittsburghers.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
A good guess.
Yep. Oh, okay. So what are you doing next year?
Next year? Oh, well, I've got a couple things on the list. I'm speaking at Event Apart Seattle, thanks to you guys. So I'm excited to come back and do another Event Apart.
Cool.
Got a couple other conferences or at least one already lined up, and I'm trying to sort out some dates for workshops so I can get back to that because I kind of missed it.
when you do you run the workshops yourself?
Most of the time, yeah. I mean, I've done them for conferences. It's always awesome when a conference wants to bring in your workshop because that's less work for me. But most of the time, I just set them up myself.
How do you do that? How do you find venues and know when they say there'll be Wi-Fi, know that there really will be Wi-Fi and all that stuff? Because that can be very challenging, I have found.
It is. It's a lot of research, a lot of asking around. I try to always only pick places where I, you know, look at places and then see if anyone I know in that city has been to them to verify that they really have what they say they have. But it's a lot of research, and you know, sometimes you get there and the Wi-Fi doesn't work all day and you just kind of got to roll with it. But mostly just a lot of research and kind of leaning on my friends for a little help.
you seem to have a huge network of friends and colleagues in the business. And how did you go about building that? Was it a, did you have the intention to build that, or has it just happened over time? And if so, how?
It's more just kind of happened. I mean, it's great to have so many people, especially when it gets coming to traveling and stuff, and you actually can go places and know people there. But it's just kind of happened from, you know, from the internet, and as silly as that sounds, but just, you know, emailing people, talking to people on Twitter or whatever else. It's just kind of happened. And, you know, going to conferences and speaking at conferences helps a lot too, because it kind of gets you out of your local, I guess, bubble. And, you know, if you're at a conference, you kind of have to talk to people you don't know, or you're going to be really lonely. So
you do a lot of traveling.
Yeah, I have in the last couple years.
How do you stay healthy?
Oh, luck. Luck and airborne, I think. It doesn't always work. I've been sick for a couple conferences, and then I always feel bad being that one sick person. Try to take care of myself as much as I can.
I hate to say it, but I do. I'm sure I have two problems. One is I have a 9-year-old in public school. Mm-hmm. So she's going to get everything and give it to me. And I hold on to it longer than anyone. And then I'm on airplanes a lot.
Those are the two of the worst places to be for getting sick.
Right. Right. And yeah. Especially if you have a night flight, mm-hmm. I can never sleep. I don't care. If I had a private room on an airplane, like if I had the most luxurious, totally, you know, if I had Kanye's room on an
he
airplane.
He probably has a really nice plane room.
I'm sure he does. I still couldn't sleep on it because there's just something about, you know, when a plane like drops 900 feet mm-hmm. in a second just because the pilot's adjusting for wind or something. And you don't notice it when you're conscious, like reading or watching a movie. But when your body's asleep and you fall 900 feet in a second, you know, and like, I just, you know, I can never fall asleep. I'm just waiting for that to happen.
It's never like a peaceful environment, at least. I mean, I don't know if Kanye's room is better than most planes, but it feels like it's not like a peaceful, quiet place to sleep.
I mean, I don't know. There's something about public sleeping too that's like, that just, it's like we're cave people again. We're all sort of, you know what I mean?
And what if you do something embarrassing while you're asleep and like someone Instagrams it or tweets it? That'd be awful.
Don't you always do? I drool in my sleep. I must confess. I don't know why I felt the need to say that, but I sometimes, I don't want to do that on an airplane.
It's like you can't be nicely composed in public and also be sleeping. It's kind of impossible.
And it's gross. Like everybody's just, I mean, it can be, it's worse on a bus. I mean, if you've ever taken a long bus trip.
Thankfully, not in a long time. But yeah, planes are much better than buses.
There's something about your 20s and buses that kind of go together, right? It's like.
Yeah, I think so.
You have no money, but you have time.
Mm-hmm. So you can take that like 9-hour bus ride to New York or whatever and not worry about it.
Well, I used to go from Indiana to Pittsburgh, right? I used to go from college to my parents in Pittsburgh mm-hmm. on a bus.
Cannot have been a short ride.
It was kind of nasty. And with one bathroom, especially.
Oh, yeah, that is the worst part about buses.
But, you know, everybody should have those experiences. I feel sorry for people who only get treated like royalty. I kind of, seriously, if your whole life has been first class, then something's wrong. You're missing something.
You're missing out on the realness of, or the dirty parts of travel.
Did you ever, before you got, I mean, I take it you kind of left college and started doing web, you know, front-end development and web design right away. Mm-hmm. Did you have, growing up or anything, kind of, you know, non-glamorous, non-web jobs?
Oh, yeah, I had some weird jobs. Some of them were fun. I taught piano for a while. That was pretty cool.
Really?
I went through the whole, like, Royal Conservatory program, totally, like, I don't know, licensed or not licensed, but approved by the Royal Conservatory to teach piano. Probably not anymore. It's been a while. But my first job ever was actually, I think the title was general laborer at a chemical plant. And I cleaned out like those big plastic chemical barrels. That was my job.
Wait, so you went from Royal Conservatory playing the classical piano repertoire mm-hmm. to cleaning out chemical tanks.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, those are just two jobs that I had when I was younger. My first job was the chemical plant, and the Royal Conservatory isn't like, I mean, it's just like, that was just, it wasn't like a school that I went to. It was just kind of like this overarching program for teaching piano. So I went to like normal school and just took lessons at night and stuff. So I wasn't like gifted or anything.
Did you actually have students?
Yeah, I did. Mostly little kids, which was really, really fun. It's awesome to teach like five-year-olds how to play the piano.
Do you still play?
I haven't had a piano in like 5 years, so I really need to get one again. It's kind of sad.
Did you ever just jam, like just improvise on a
Not on piano, because I feel like all my music lessons taught me to always sight read and never play a note that wasn't on the paper. But I also played guitar, and that was, I just learned that all by ear and didn't bother ever learning to read music for it on purpose.
Got it. That is, yeah. My mom was a classical musician, but she couldn't improvise, and she hated when I would improvise because she thought I would like go, she'd say like, play the notes that are there. And I go, well, I like these notes better.
Oh, you'd never say that to a piano teacher. Oh my goodness, you get in so much trouble.
No, I know. It was terrible. Yeah.
And it's funny how that just gets ingrained in your head. And it's like, maybe I could do it now because it's been so long, but I was never able to just improvise on piano. I just couldn't do it. I was like, but it was so ingrained. Play notes on paper.
You do it on guitar. That's fine.
That's
a great instrument too. That's a great instrument. And I think very difficult. I mean, all of them are easy to start making noises on and impossible to master. You could really, you could really go your whole life just working on music. Do you miss music?
I do. You know, I hadn't really thought about it for a while, but the last couple of years I've kind of really missed it. I mean, in a way, a lot of web design stuff kind of reminds me of like being in bands and doing that stuff where you kind of get together with a group of people for a project and you have no idea how it's really going to go exactly, but you're just trying to, you're all getting together to make something. And that's kind of the same feel as being in a band in a way. You know, you're creating stuff together, and it would not be the same if you didn't have that, all the team members working together. But, you know, it's not as expressive, I guess. You know, you're still working for a client as opposed to just making stuff up yourself.
The nice thing is you're getting paid. That's the other difference. But yeah, no, that I never heard it put that way before. That's really insightful and interesting. It is a lot like being in a band, and you sort of find people because sometimes a certain person might be really talented, but you can't play with them for whatever reason, right? Like there's this great drummer who's amazing, but you can't keep time with that drummer, and you'd rather, and it's the same with projects. Like there are just designers, developers, et cetera, these different, you know, that are just, you know, I think they're all good, but there are certain people you get along with better and you can get work done. And sometimes, sadly, some of the most brilliant people I work with, I've had trouble. It's probably me. It's probably not them, but just maintaining, just maintaining a healthy, happy, harmonious working relationship can be a challenge. I find. How do you? So you still do a lot of freelance projects and put them together? Do you put the projects together, like land the account and say I'm going to work with so and so and so and so, or are you a gun for hire, or how does that work?
A little of both. I like to make it, it's kind of nice when it's an even split, you know, because when you're the gun for hire, there's someone else managing the project. If you're really lucky, there's actually a project manager, which is my favorite. And then, you know, you can focus more on getting the work done and less so on like, how is the project going? But when I'm the person that, you know, is the client facing person who got the account together, I always work with somebody else. I usually at least get a developer to work with me to do all the stuff that they are amazingly better at than I am, like setting up a CMS. And you know, it's no fun to work on a project yourself for a client. You know, it's better to have at least one other person, and you can get stuff done so much faster, and you have that sounding board that you need to kind of, you know, just make things better in the end.
That can turn into a studio. I mean, that's how HappyCog started. Originally, it was just me. And then I started working with other people, freelance at first, just like, you know, Brian Alvey doing the back end, and then, you know, and later other people. And just, it was kind of, you know, working with Doug Bowman. I mean, I'm pulling like names from prehistory, like amazing, like rock stars now. But
they're doing amazing things.
They are doing amazing things. But everyone we work with is kind of that way. I always feel that way too. Like, just every time I work with people, I'm amazed how smart they are and how passionate they are. I don't really know anybody who phones it in this business.
That is, I've noticed the same thing. You know, I've worked with a lot of different people over the last couple of years, and it is really amazing just, you know, how passionate everyone is about what they're doing and wanting to do it well, and you know, putting in everything they can on projects, which is, it's really nice to work with people like that. I mean, that kind of makes the idea of being freelance totally worth it, right? If everyone you work with is just as invested, it's great.
I totally agree. And I'm old enough that I've had other careers. I mean, not for decades and decades, but I've done other things professionally for some, you know, good chunk of years. And I've never experienced the same level of passionate commitment to excellence and support of one another, mm-hmm. that I found in web design. Like, I think other fields that I worked in, like journalism and advertising, there were definitely people who were great and passionate about being great, but I never got the feeling that they also cared that what happened to me.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that really makes all the difference between actually working as a team and just kind of being, you know, people all out for themselves. And the second one doesn't sound as fun at all.
Yeah, I think working is, it's the greatest reward of this whole thing to me. Just like people, just mm-hmm. working with amazing people, and discovering that like almost everybody we work with is really amazing and really smart. I don't know. It's pretty easy for a person who works in this field to say, boy, we're just the greatest people. And so I know that's kind of self-aggrandizing, but I'm really just blown away all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is a little bit, in a way, you know, to say we're the best ever. But I think there's a little truth to that, even if you, you know, step back and look at the bigger picture. I think there's just a lot of really great people in our industry, and that makes us really lucky. I don't think it's like that everywhere else. So I feel lucky.
That's you're one of those great people, and that's a very nice closing thought to sort of wrap this up, because mm-hmm. old Mr. Clock is telling us it's about time to do that.
Okay.
If webdesignday.com mm-hmm. is where people can go for information. Well, on last year's conference, it'll be a while before they get to the next one.
We'll get to it.
Yep. people can find you at valhead.com, mm-hmm. Which is your website and blog, and where you, and they can find you at VLH mm-hmm. on Twitter.
That's Twitter.
And Valhead, VALHEAD, on Dribbble. Mm-hmm. And LeoCap on Flickr.
I know, you can't change those old usernames, damn it.
Yeah, what's that about? Really, you can't?
No, you can't change your username. Once it's there, it's done on Flickr. And I'm like, oh, darn. I've had Flickr forever, so goodness, that was ages ago.
I love Flickr. So, okay, and you can find you on creativejs.com, mm-hmm. and it's very much worth checking out CSS Animations, a tiny little book chock full of information from the good people at Five Simple Steps. And Valhead, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to chat.
Pleasure. I want to thank HostGator, our sponsor, and I want to thank our listeners today, and we'll see you again on another Big Web Show. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.